Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to this edition of Vatican Weekend. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be sharing with you a reflection by the title of Men Are From Mars, Women From Venus, bringing you a potted history of the popes of the 20th century, as well as a picture in sound focusing on Paul VI and the moon landing. I'll also be taking you with me to the Shrine of Divine Mercy at Waganiki, a Krakow suburb, which Pope Francis will visit at the end of July, a place linked to St. John Paul II. But first, I'd like you to listen to Alexander MacDonald's report in the context of a Jubilee Year of Mercy audience held by Pope Francis in St. Peter's Square on Thursday, 30th of June.
It's one thing to talk mercy, but quite another to live it, Pope Francis said. Mercy is not an abstraction or a lifestyle, and paraphrasing the words of St. James the Apostle, mercy without works is dead in itself.
La misericordia senza le opere è morta in se stessa.
Pope Francis used the text of Matthew 25:31 as a launching point for discussing acts of mercy towards others. What makes mercy come alive is its dynamism to meet the spiritual and material needs of others, he said. Mercy has eyes to see, ears to listen, hands to help lift.
La misericordia ha occhi per vedere, orecchi per ascoltare, mani per risollevare.
Sometimes we pass by dramatic situations of poverty, and it seems that they don't touch us, the Pope said.
A volte passiamo davanti a situazioni di drammatica povertà.
We continue as if nothing happened, in an indifference which ultimately makes us hypocrites, and without realizing it, leads to a form of spiritual lethargy that numbs the soul and leaves life barren.
Senza che ce ne rendiamo conto, sfocia in una forma di letargo spirituale che rende insensibile l'animo e sterile la vita.
Those who have experienced mercy in their own lives, the Pope continued, cannot remain indifferent to the needs of our brothers. The teaching of the Lord Jesus does not allow for escape routes. I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was naked, displaced, sick, and in prison, and you visited me. I'm Alexander MacDonald.
When Pope Francis travels to Poland to preside over World Youth Day at the end of July, he'll be going to the Shrine of Divine Mercy at Waganiki, a place dear to St. John Paul II. Stay tuned. It's a Polish story which takes us to a leafy Krakow suburb by the name of Waganiki, at a time in history when this nation was behind the so-called Iron Curtain and under the yoke of a communist regime, and when Karol Wojtyła, the future Pope John Paul II, was growing up in the nearby town of Wadowice. Today, in this place, there exists a shrine where pilgrims flock. It's that of Divine Mercy, one Pope Francis is scheduled to visit at the end of July when he travels to Krakow to preside over World Youth Day during this Jubilee year dedicated to mercy. He'll be doing so in continuity with two of his predecessors to the See of Peter, the last being Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, and the other, you'll have guessed, the Polish pontiff, John Paul II, now a saint, the pope to launch World Youth Days. So Francis then will be going to a place linked in a special way to the visions of a Polish sister by the name of Faustina Kowalska, who lived and prayed there in the first half of the 20th century and was later canonized by John Paul II during the Jubilee year 2000. But let's glance at how this devotion came about. And at its message. The date was the 22nd of February 1931, with the first of a series of apparitions which Sister Faustina describes in a diary of some 600 pages. a personal witness of divine revelations and mystical experiences. This diary is written in a spidery calligraphy and not only unveils a powerful message of hope in a world in the shadow of the fearful humanity of the time, but also reveals an image of that apparition of the Lord Jesus, who appeared to her clothed in a white garment, with two rays of light emanating from his breast, one red and one white. The red, she writes, symbolic of blood, representing the life of souls, and the other white, symbolizing water, which makes souls righteous. These are her exact words.
In the evening when I was in my cell, I saw the Lord Jesus clothed in a white garment. One hand was raised in a gesture of blessing. The other was touching the garment at the breast. From beneath the garment, slightly drawn aside at the breast, there were emanating two large rays, one red, the other pale. In silence, I kept my gaze fixed on the Lord. My soul was filled with awe, but also with great joy. After a while, Jesus said to me, "Paint an image according to the pattern you see, with the signature, 'Jesus, I trust in you.' I desire that this image be venerated, first in your chapel, and then throughout the world."
And at the Shrine of Divine Mercy at Waganiki, a copy of this painting of the merciful Jesus stands above the main altar. The original is to be found only yards away, in the chapel where Sister Faustina once prayed her chaplet, following her first vision. At the dedication mass of the large new basilica on the 7th of August 2002, John Paul II mentioned in a moment of nostalgia how he used to come to the little chapel to pray as a young man when he went by on his way to the Solvay chemical plant where he once worked. And rather famously he remarked on that occasion, "Who would ever have imagined that the young man in his wooden clogs would one day be back here in his capacity as Roman pontiff to dedicate a new basilica to Divine Mercy?" Earlier still, during that homily, he had highlighted the spiritual importance of the message of mercy at a time when mankind was experiencing bewilderment in the face of many manifestations of evil. "How greatly the world needs God's mercy," he insisted.
In every continent, from the depth of human suffering, a cry for mercy seems to rise up.
На всіх континентах з глибин людського черпіння здається вносить волання милосердя. Там, де панує ненависть,
where hatred and the thirst for revenge dominate, where war brings suffering and death to the innocent, there the grace of mercy is needed in order to settle human minds and hearts and to bring about peace. Wherever respect for life and human dignity are lacking, there is need of God's merciful love, in whose light we see the inexpressible value of every human being. Mercy is needed in order to ensure that every injustice in the world will come to an end in the splendor of truth.
Потреба милосердя, аби всяка несправедливость на свете зналазла крест блеску правды.
What began as a very Polish devotion has now spread right across the world. And in July, when Pope Francis travels to Krakow for World Youth Day, no doubt many thousands of young pilgrims from the four corners of the earth will rally around him during this Jubilee year dedicated to mercy, here at the Shrine of Krakow Waganiki, where the legacy of Saint Faustina Kowalska lives on to this day. Time now to move on in the broadcast for a bird's eye view relating to the popes of the 20th century. Since canonized a saint, he's Papa Giuseppe Sarto, who took the name of Pius X when he was elected to the See of Peter on the 4th of August, 1903. A man who was then described by one of the cardinals who elected him, Cardinal Mathieu, a father and a shepherd. Interestingly, this view of a pope who would be more of a father and a shepherd and less of a politician was also shared by the Catholic rulers of that time in Europe. In 1903, they still exercised their right of veto over the choice of a Roman pontiff. It was to be for the last time, ironically one of the first gestures of the very man they had chosen as pope, was to remove this ancient privilege from them. When this pope died in the summer of 1914, Europe was at war. People said he died of a broken heart. The idea of a great war had proved too much for him to bear. And when the cardinals gathered in conclave to elect a new pope, the man they chose to play that capital and unprecedented role which the war offered to the Holy See proved no fortuitous choice. He was an experienced diplomat. His name was Giacomo della Chiesa, and taking the name of Benedict XV, he was elected to the See of Peter on the 3rd of September 1914. And the war he fought so hard to stop finally ended 4 years into his pontificate at the 11th hour of the 11th day of November 1918. Pope Benedict XV rejoiced. His war pontificate was over. Since 1914, he'd written 3 encyclicals about peace. The name of the third pope of the 20th century was Achille Ratti, who took the name of Pope Pius XI. Elected on the 6th of February 1922, his first gesture was unexpected. A pope had not appeared on the balcony looking out towards St. Peter's Square, towards the Italian state, since 1870. He was the pope who would settle the Roman question by signing the Lateran Pax. But he was also the founder of our radio station, and that's why, since the time of Pius XI, we have recordings of all the pope's voices. Beginning with an appeal for peace he himself made in September 1938, exactly a year before the outbreak of the Second World War.
La trepidazione di tanti nostri figli.
We were in France there, and a radio message it must have been. Yes, it was when there was tension with Hitler already in 1938.
Rosminian father Charles Leroux recalls hearing this message in Paris as a young man.
In that message, he offered to God his life in exchange for peace for humanity.
That call for peace on the part of Pius XI was repeated many times by the pope who followed him, Pius XII. Papa Pacelli was elected on the 2nd of March 1939, and war raged throughout most of his pontificate. Less than a month after the outbreak of the Second World War, Pius XII published his first encyclical, Summi Pontificatus, on the unity of human society. In the encyclical, the new pope branded racial prejudice as the most pernicious of modern errors and condemned, quote, the forgetfulness of that law of human solidarity dictated by the equality of rational nature in all persons to whatever people they belong, unquote. On October the 28th, 1939, in Britain, the Times commented on the encyclical under the headline, New Idolatry Condemned. And across the Atlantic, the New York Times carried an almost identical headline.
Pope condemns persecution.
The New York Times editorial ran as follows.
The voice of Pius XII is a lonely voice in the silence and darkness enveloping Europe this Christmas. He is about the only ruler left on the continent of Europe who dares to raise his voice at all.
The regal Pope Pius XII was succeeded by a very different-looking pope, gone down in history as good Pope John. But while this pope may have written an encyclical on peace, Pacem in Terris, he's gone down in history for a very different reason.
Mm-hmm. we were all taken aback when we saw how small Pope John was. He seemed a kind of little miniature sort of person in comparison with the figure of Pius XII. This stubby little character seemed a complete contrast with Pius XII.
In those years, Monsignor Charles Burns was studying for the priesthood in Rome.
And certainly what we didn't for a moment suspect was that within 2 or 3 months, when was this? He was elected the end of October of 58. And 25th of January 59, he calls the Ecumenical Council. Well, I mean, that morning, coming down to the Gregorian with all the newspapers, all the headlines, Ecumenical Council called.
Il convenire odierno del Sacro Collegio Cardinalizio, della prelatura e del popolo romano in questa basilica di San Paolo fuori le mura.
He did this on his own. Even his Secretary of State, as far as I know, Cardinal Tardini, didn't know about this.
Carmelite Father Redemptus Vallerbeck was also a seminarian at that exciting time in the history of the Catholic Church.
And the cardinals were astounded. I remember one of them thought he was hearing things. He couldn't believe it. They had spoken about a council under Pius XII, but they had decided against it because it was complicated. And of course, you stir up things that sometimes it's better left lie fallow. So I think they felt if Pius XII, who was an intellectual, couldn't handle it and didn't feel that it was the right time, you know, how would this rather simple man do it? But that was what he called the inspiration of the Spirit. He felt that the Spirit was calling him to do that, to let a bit of fresh air into the church, and to open up windows. And he has used that expression. I think he meant it literally, to open up new venues for the church.
Venerabiles fratres, gaudet mater ecclesia, quot singulari divine providentiae munere, optatissimus iam dies illuxit.
And when Pope John XXIII died, his successor, Giovanni Battista Montini, who took the name of Paul VI on the 21st of June 1963, found himself with the delicate task of closing and implementing the Second Vatican Council. He was not always understood.
He was very gentle, and he was a gentleman. Perhaps the world didn't quite understand him.
William Wakefield Baum, created cardinal by Pope Paul VI. The world Paul VI lived in was a changing world, the same inhabited by America's first Catholic president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, with whom he'd met less than 2 weeks into his pontificate.
Standard of living for you citizens.
But while the young American president's world was modern, vital, and projected into the 21st century, the newly elected Pope's world was deeply anchored into the past, rife with pomp and circumstance. A situation Paul VI was determined to change, when, in a symbolic gesture, he cancelled one of the Catholic Church's centuries-old traditions by giving away the Triple Crown. And again, when this last pope ever to be crowned brought it upon himself to become the first pilgrim pope. But despite these gestures of hope, the decade and a half of his pontificate was also marked with a string of situations of conflict for which Pope Paul VI had anticipated an impelling plea for peace in October 1965. As Cardinal John Foley recalled,
it was the first visit of a pope to the United Nations. Even some of the people from communist states felt the power of what he was saying.
And that takes us to 1978, the year gone down in history as the year of the three popes. I'll read you a list of dates that eventually led to the election of Pope John Paul II. On the 16th of October of that same year. August the 6th, Giovanni Battista Montini, Pope Paul VI, dies in Castel Gandolfo at the age of 81, after a 15-year pontificate. August 26th, the Cardinal Patriarch of Venice, Albino Luciani, is elected Pope, taking the name of Pope John Paul I. September 28th, the bells of St. Peter's toll to let the world know the newly elected Pope is dead. Barely a month had gone by since they had tolled for Pope Paul VI, and people listened in disbelief. People like Cardinal William Wakefield Baum, one of the members of the very College of Cardinals to elect Pope John Paul I.
One of my priests called me, and he said, "The Pope has died." And my first reaction is, "You're mistaken. You must have been listening to a program about the death of Pope Paul VI.
He had been reading one of his homilies. I was there.
Bishop John McGee, personal secretary to Pope John Paul I.
He wanted to refresh his mind, because now that he was Pope, he would have to give many homilies.
Dear sons and daughters, it is about love that I want to speak to you today.
His pontificate, although brief, was, from our point of view, a moment of grace. He again appeared to everyone as a very loving father.
Our Heavenly Father wants us perfect like this.
And when Pope John Paul II was elected as the 263rd successor of Peter, his pontificate was to last for over a quarter of a century. It was he who led the Catholic Church into the third millennium. I hope you enjoyed that collage relating to all of the popes of the 20th century. In a related story, I'd like to share with you a sound picture of the moon landing. It was the 20th of July 1969 when Pope Paul VI sent a radio message hurtling through space across a 250,000-mile void to the men who had just fulfilled an ancient human dream, that of walking on the moon.
Pope Paul VI is speaking to you, astronauts. Honor, greetings and blessing to you, conquerors of the moon.
For Pope Paul VI, the moonwalk was a recognition of the greatness of God's handiwork. The moon itself, he personified poetically as the pale lamp of our nights.
Pale lamp of our nights and our dreams, bring to her, with your living presence, the voice of the Spirit.
As the tiny lunar module neared the surface of the moon, scouring the landscape for a safe stretch to touch down on, all over the world, people scoured the fuzzy images from space on their television screens, anxious to see what would happen. Pope Paul was no exception. He too watched the landing from his summer residence in Castel Gandolfo, which houses the Vatican Observatory. And as Neil Armstrong stepped down on the powdery surface of the moon, Pope Paul VI clapped his hands and said,
"We are close to you with our good wishes and with our prayers. Together with the whole Catholic Church."
Often caught peering at lunar landscapes through the telescope at the Vatican Observatory, Paul VI had always shown a special interest in space travel. In the very first speech of his pontificate, he said that with the blessing of God, it had opened up a new era for humanity. And on a later occasion, he had given an astronaut a specially engraved bronze plaque to be laid on the surface of the moon with the words from a psalm, "O Lord our God, how great your name throughout the earth." In return, he got a piece of the moon, which today is still kept at Castel Gandolfo. You were listening there to a couple of archive programmes from the late 1990s, in which you heard the personal witness of Monsignor Charles Burns, the late Cardinals William Wakefield Baum and John Patrick Foley, and the late Fathers John Charles Leroux and Redemptus Valabek. Finally, I'd like to join Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who's about to bring us a reflection by the title of Men from Mars, Women from Venus. It's part of the series Why Bother? Staying Catholic Despite It All.
There's something terrifying in the gospel about poor Lazarus and the rich man. You must remember it. The rich man basically ignores the plight of the poor man and goes on enjoying life, quite oblivious of how much Lazarus suffers. When they die, guess who goes to hell? In the distance, the rich man sees Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham and asks whether Lazarus can come and comfort him. But Abraham's terrifying reply is that between us and you, a great gulf has been fixed to stop anyone, even if he wanted to, crossing from our side to yours, and to stop any crossing from your side to ours. In other words, it was too late. The rich man had had his chance. I think what I'm about to say will get me into enormous trouble. but I'm prepared to take the risk. Even before we die, we all experience another great gulf where never the twain shall meet, and that is the enormous gap between women and men. I'm not saying there is no genuine or successful communication between men and women, just to suggest that our take on the world is so different that good, open communication is essential. Otherwise, things can go disastrously wrong. They sometimes go wrong even when great care is taken. So people often say in desperation, "Why bother? Will we ever get it right?" I have overheard many conversations recently about a book called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. It's one of those things that really divide people. They either love the book or hate it. It's not a scientific book, but there is more than a grain of truth in many of the things it contains. I listened to extracts read by the author on a tape in my friend's car as he drove me from London to Cornwall. It made us both laugh, but more importantly, it got us talking about the subject, the radically different ways women and men experience life, the world, and especially relationships. One of the things that saddens me immensely is a contrast between the way Jesus related to women in the Gospels and the way women today relate to the church, particularly to priests and bishops. In a world where two dirty old men could almost have an honourable woman put to death because they could not have their way with her, until the young prophet Daniel tricked them into revealing their wickedness, Jesus was able to calm a crowd intent on stoning another woman to death by forcing them to be honest about their own failings. He broke through cultural taboos and touched the heart of a Samaritan woman whose life was a mess. In both cases, he made it clear that their lives needed to be sorted out, but his style was not so much to condemn as to enlighten. It is frustrating that in an age where women are generally able to live a satisfying life, free from many of the psychological and sociological limitations of the ancient world, so many Christian women feel uneasy in the church. I remember trying to address this question when I ran a parish in northern England. I made several copies of a new publication for Catholic women available free of charge to anyone who wanted them. Nobody signed up. I asked a few women why, and between the lines of their polite replies, it became clear that it was just absurd for a man to try to set up a women's group. I actually only wanted there to be a space for them to meet with their own agenda, without me or any other men, but I had miscalculated completely. So I gave the magazines to a woman in the parish who has distributed them with much greater success ever since. She has also become part of a very vocal and active women's group in the Archdiocese. I had another disaster since then, which was when I had to give some talks to a group involved in catechesis. When I spoke about ecofeminism, some of the women wanted the full text, but refused to talk about it. I was mystified, but in the light of earlier experience, decided to be patient. Again, polite words in my ear let me know that there was no way anger against the church was going to be aired in front of an agent of the Vatican. Fair enough. The question still remains, though. There is a gap. And the irony is that people on both sides are saying, "Why bother?" very loudly.
You were listening there to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood from the Liverpool Archdiocese in England. That brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to find out more about our programming, check out our website at www.rv.va. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.